You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, this is Jen Graves, and you're listening to Invisible, The Stranger's weekly conversation with people in art. I'm here at the Platform Gallery in Pioneer Square with Eric Ely.
Hello.
Hi. And we are sitting next to Eric's installation called Prospect Fields. The installation has been up for a few weeks, and it's coming down soon, but we're going to talk about it before it does. And it's a sort of landscape that fills the entire front space of the gallery at Platform with string. And the string is sort of shaped in it's kind of rolling hills that are red, made of red string, and on and affixed to kind of silver painted
dowels
that look a little bit sort of like energy or like electrical poles or something, mm-hmm. You know, sticking up from the floor. And through the space run several kind of lightning bolts of wood, which I'm sure the association is not intended, and it sounds unfortunate that way. But these kind of, they also behave, one of them behaves a little bit like a bridge that you walk under when you follow the path kind of through this landscape. And there are a couple of things to kind of note. It's hard to describe when you're not here, but the shapes that are on the walls and the shapes that are on the floors, so you're walking underneath some of the shapes created by the string, and you're walking next to and kind of above some of the other shapes made in string, they suggest solids, but it's all this sort of web. So the shadows that are cast on the wall, for example, in the back corner by the strings, create these kind of three-dimensional drawings in the space, so that you'll have the real gray string, and then behind that is the shadow of the gray string, and coming up from the bottom of that is this this sort of shadow that also creates, if you linked, in other words, the real thing and the shadow thing, you'd have a three-dimensional
volume.
Yes. Yeah. Can you talk about the way this is made first? Because people often think that you have sort of sketched this all out on a computer and then you sort of just put it in a space.
Yes. Normally I do some sketching, like drawings, but usually once I get into the space, the actual form that it takes isn't like those, because as much as I, you know, go from photographs to the actual space and do, you know, dimensional drawings of it, once you're in there, it totally changes. And once I get the elements that are pre-built into the space, it changes how I want the other things to happen. So I do some sketching, but mainly it's just drawings. And then, for instance, for the red low landscape that you talked about, I built a floor in my studio, a chunk of floor, so that I could replicate sort of what was going to happen here. And I did tests, and I did a few different systems of drawing with the string and dowels and different things that I made, and came up with this as the way I wanted to work, but it was only an 8x10 section of floor. But based on that, I knew how many elements I wanted, how many pieces I needed to make, and then just came to the gallery with all the dowels and spools of string. And once the large like angular wooden element, the lightning bolt as you called it, was installed and the overhead was installed, I then worked on the overhead string, mm-hmm. which used existing anchors in the ceiling. It's one of those problems that you, which problems you choose and don't, like, you know, I put a floor in the gallery because I didn't want to deal with the floor that they had. It didn't work for me, but the floor is not really part of the piece. It just helped me make the piece the way I wanted to. But then I chose to use anchors that were already in the ceiling.
The ceiling has all its own suggestions.
Yeah, because that's the sort of problem that I enjoy. Like, working with the existing floor is just work. It's just labor. Whereas working with what's above was more of an intellectual problem to figure out how it could work. So I did those overheads. Once the main element was installed, once that was finished, the floor was painted. And I just, with a drill, freehand, you know, sort of drilled all the holes and built out from there. And once all the dowels are in the ground, it all gets strung together.
So you first build all the dowels, then you string.
Yeah, all the dowels are in the floor before it got strung. So, and what I like about that is, although a lot of people, like you said, get a sense, I think at first, I think once you spend time with my work, you realize that there is some spontaneity and you can see my hand in it, but the initial reaction to it is that it's very clean and sort of, I think initially people might think my work's a little cold, but that's not, that would, if someone walked away after seeing the show that way, I would be disappointed. Mm-hmm. No, I don't feel like my work's cold, but,
Well, you have a joke in this work.
Yes, I have a sense of humor.
It is, it's sort of a nice joke, which is that the tiny little tops of the dowels are all painted green, and you almost don't notice it at first, but there are really like dozens of little tiny green areas, sort of indicating in this landscape of red that looks really not much like a landscape at all, the sort of like grassy surface.
Generic landscape color.
Generic, yeah.
Because, and then it also works too, it's like playing, you know, obviously I love formal concerns, you know, green versus red, it's nice. Otherwise that little dot wouldn't pop out at all if there was nothing for it to contrast against. But yes.
But people tell you that your work is cold.
No one has told me. I've had the question usually in context of like, do you want your work to be like distant and this, or do you want it to be more welcome? And it's like, my work, and I think my answer for that is, you know, I don't want it to be cold, but it's definitely not the work that, you know, you have to come to it, I think, most of the time. My work is something that you approach. It does not sort of come after you. It's not jumping out
well,
at you.
One thing about it is you certainly do have to be in the space with it.
Mm-hmm.
That in order to kind of gather the sort of jokes, or not jokes, but sort of visual play that's going on with the shadows and the actual string, and then some of the gray string is painted white so that it sort of fades when you're looking at the shapes on the wall, and so you end up not being sure whether the shadow is the real string or the white painted string is the real string, like which string is the real string. There's a kind of there's a sort of minimalist quality to that, you know, those sort of operations that a judge will play or will ask, will sort of put in front of you to deal with. And, you know, you've said before that Julie Moretu is an influence on your work, and I wanted also to ask you about Fred Sandbach, another man of string, obviously.
And
are you a fan of his work too?
I'm a fan of his work, and I'm a fan of Julie's too. I don't know if I list Julie as an influence as someone as much as like someone who I think started with some of the same references I started with, or sort of how I found my way to this work. I think is probably how this the same way she found her way to her work is like looking at maps and sort of factual information or visual factual information that's given to you and realizing that it's fairly subjective what information is included in those sort of factual documents, and then what happens when you take that information and use that vocabulary to your own devices, and then what associations, because I think automatically people, you know, they assume that her work and my work is sort of factual, that it must come from a specific reference. And I think a lot of her work does come from semi-specific references, and then it just sort of explodes from there. But I'm not looking, like, but I also, like, people walk in and think this is, I was looking at a specific landscape or a specific something, or there's a photograph or
it's total drawing,
it's
a fiction.
It's not. It's all, it's built from the ground up rather than the other way. But as far as Fred Sandbach, I do like his work a lot, because I like simple minimalist work. And I like including those sorts of moments in my work, but that's not my goal, is to boil things down. I'm actually looking to go messier than that, and I think that happens over time with my work.
Well, it's also tempting to look at a work like this and think that it's about the space, that in some way it's, you know, like a conditioned and conditioned by the space and driving you back to look back at the space. And there is certainly a lot of work that will do that, but this work doesn't do that, actually. It doesn't make me look back at the space. I look back at the space and all, like in the ceiling, sort of in these kind of hooks that the strings come out of, you know, my eye is drawn up to that, and I think, oh, that's part of the space. But then my eye comes right back down through those, you know, that kind of like outpouring of string. So it's not a way, it doesn't seem to me, I don't experience it as another way to consider this gallery space.
No, I think I agree with how you say it, because it is a reaction to the space. I try to make something that fits the space well, but if I do my job well, you notice the space, but it's not about the space. It's meant to fit well in the space. It's meant to be comfortable, or, you know, maybe challenge the proportions of the space a little bit, or, you know, because when you walk in, there's something right over your head, but that's partly to bring you down. Mm-hmm. Because there is so much going on above in this sort of industrial space, mm-hmm. that I don't, you know, I have to sort of live in harmony with that and not compete with that, but I also don't want to, like, overdo it either.
But the space is not the subject, the object is the subject.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is the idea that's most influenced your work?
Sort of where all my work springs from is the idea that all you need to do most things are sort of basic building blocks. I love basic building blocks and the fact that the potential to do, you know, almost everything is contained all the way back down at those basic building blocks. And sort of, I talk about math and physics fairly often with my work, and, you know, I can more readily probably say my favorite mathematician as quickly as I can say my favorite artists. And it's based on his story, which is part of a myth. His name's Ramanujan. I don't know if that's a proper way to say his name. And he's sort of like an Einstein character in that he was an Indian sort of clerk who had what would be relatively remedial math books for most of us, more than we could ever understand. But for the time, even that he was doing it was not the most updated information. It was behind the times, and by himself with that book, with the basic building blocks of mathematics, he was able to extrapolate things that people hadn't found yet. And people at first thought he was crazy because he would send the things around the world. And one mathematician, G.H. Hardy, in England, recognized something in these handwritten papers that he just got in the mail and brought him to study with him. And now there's people whose entire careers are devoted to figuring out this man's notebooks, because they thought he was crazy because he used sort of simple systems to find extremely complex things. And I don't have a full grasp on it, but I don't think they thought that was really possible, that he could have gotten to this and that it could be true because he didn't have the latest technology or the latest information. And so that all, you know, that sort of story, although it's become sort of, you know, a bit of a myth, it is true. He had simple building materials, and with those, he was able to figure out things that people hadn't yet. And so I generally work only with lines, points, and planes. I do a little bit of shading now in drawings and things, but it's lines, points, and planes. And I think those three things have the ability to build almost anything I can imagine. And, you know, if you're up close, you'll see the angles, but I think you also can back up and those things become curves. It all depends on your perspective and the scale you're working at. But I think mainly in those terms, because I want to find my way to complex things using those basic building blocks, because that's how I sort of understand the world, or how I best understand things. I like asking basic questions that sometimes sound sort of dumb when I'm first learning about something, even though I can probably figure out that answer on my own. It's sort of that give and take of, like, I ask a question, someone who knows tells me the answer to that one, and then I step on top of that and step and step and step. And so that's where all my work comes from, mm-hmm. is sort of this, the sublime ability of those basic building blocks, addition, subtraction, can lead to, at certain times, hopefully, they multiply rather than just add. You know, and my background's in ceramics, and there's this thing called a eutectic in ceramics. It's like when you combine two chemicals And instead of you being able to calculate where they'll melt or something, because this one melts at this and this melts at that, so 50-50, they should melt right in the middle. But occasionally that's not true. You mix them together and they melt at a much, much lower temperature. And there's no real way to predicting that. You just find it. And I think that's sort of a weird scientific way of articulating, I think, what a lot of artists are after, or a lot of us are after in a lot of aspects of your life. You hope sometimes all those pieces work together in a way that you couldn't have predicted. You know all the parts, you understand all the parts, but once they're all together, they do something you couldn't have foreseen ahead of time.
Mm-hmm. What's the way that you got from ceramics to this?
I started out as a potter, wood firing kilns, and went to school specifically for that. I got into it in high school, and then in school, I made pots that started to reference architecture and things, and so I started making lots of teapots and things, which are fun because they have all the different parts, and they would look like different things, but they worked perfectly. I'm sort of a purist in one sense, in that if I was going to make a teapot, it was going to be the best working teapot I could make. It was going to be sculptural. But because of how they look, no one used them. So then I was like, well, why am I making something that's to be used if no one's ever going to use it? So I dropped the function and just sort of did the references, and it was very sort of direct architectural things. And those started to morph into slightly more organic because, architecture is built to human proportions, so I started working with proportions and they would get more organic. It was very industrial things. And then when I left grad school, I did a residency in Montana for a couple of years at a ceramics residency. And my work
at Archie Bray?
At the Archie Bray Foundation. And I started to have some problems with ceramics, but mainly because it wasn't the schedule I liked working on. Like, you have to baby clay, and you can't really walk away from it for very long. And I needed something much more immediate. And clay has one phase of it is that very immediate, but then a lot of the rest of it happens behind closed doors, and that just didn't make sense to me. And I started to sew and add those things to the pieces. And when I left the Bray, I actually took a couple of years off before I went back to grad school, trying to figure out if this is sort of what I wanted to do. And in that time, from sewing, I got interested in upholstery. I thought those techniques made more sense to me because of the scale they work at, and they're not as delicate. And so I hired on with a master upholsterer, although a horrible business. He was very knowledgeable, and I learned from him and took those skills back to the studio.
You became
studio.
A professional upholstery seamster.
Yeah, I was a seamstress. So I did custom-built furniture, but I did all the sewing as well.
And once you say that, then you start to see all the seams in your work. You start to see the stitches.
Yeah, I love connections. Mm-hmm. And what happened inside of furniture interested me much more than the skin of it, because there's all these techniques to make everything work well. Mm-hmm.
It's that question of connecting the dots, right? And sort of them adding up to more than you can expect before you connect them.
Yeah.
The flat work here is that's on display at the platform is really helpful to getting a sense of what you're working on. And there are, I think, 4 or 5 different pieces, and some of them are, is this watercolor?
No, all the color on both the resin drawings and the works on paper, other than the lines, is dry pigment rubbed on the surface of the paper.
Okay.
So it's all dry material.
Okay. And so you're working on paper and in resin also. Mm-hmm. And the resin drawings are, they're actually layered.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually drill holes. There's a sort of painting or drawing actually on the surface of these planes, then beneath there, on another layer beneath, and then there are these sort of constellations that sort of shine out from under several layers of resin.
Mm-hmm.
And you've made them in part by drilling holes and then filling some of them and leaving other ones, other ones empty. And
so the drawing's a really physical process. Everything I do, it tends to, in most of the illusion in my drawings isn't actually illusion. Most of it isn't. Because as something recedes, it's because it's covered. I don't tend to draw in lighter colors or use lighter colors of things. They just get covered over so often, and that's very literal with the resins, because there's five layers of drawing that are only about a 16th of an inch thick.
The depth is literal.
So yeah, the depth is literal. You know,
it's like Frank Stella, what you see is what you see.
Yeah. But then with the works on paper, it all ends up flat, but there are also probably 10 to 12 layers of drawing on each piece of paper, and mm-hmm. I draw, and then mm-hmm. I take makeup applicators, big like body puffs, and mm-hmm. rub over the whole thing with the pigment, and then draw again.
Makeup applicators?
Yeah.
Huh.
I found sort of the best way to get
really?
The stuff on there. So yes, my local Walgreens using. Thinks I'm a cross-dresser, but... Because, you know, two for one eyeshadow applicators and body puffs, and I'm a happy man. But so that's how it's all applied on there. And then so the first layer of drawing ends up covered and oftentimes completely obliterated by the upper layers. But I draw at every stage. I draw on the paper before I even put pigment on it. And usually that layer is not visible by the end.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always something happening at every layer. So the depth in them, for the most part, is actual.
Mm-hmm.
It's real as well. It just happens on a flat plane.
Well, now I'm going to turn you into a liar, because that's changing.
It is changing.
Your most recent drawing here is something where there is actually shading that indicates sort of a recession in space.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talked a little bit about that being something... you know, the drawing's also kind of moving off of the page, sort of indicating that it's a portrait of one area
mm-hmm.
of a real space that's much larger.
Mm-hmm.
So you said you feel like you've earned that now.
Yes, and I think having talked about the other stuff first is sort of how I learn and ask simple questions. You know, I'm a very reality, practical, rational-based person. So I never felt I could jump to creating this illusion, because I'm also not very narrative, and it felt like I would like jump to this narrative or something if I was making this a window onto something rather than just sort of a completely self-contained drawing. So, you know, I didn't draw as artwork until the end of graduate school. So I've only been drawing as something that I would actually show to someone 3 years, maybe.
So you graduated in 2005 from UW.
Yes.
Ceramics.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And so, you know, and even in some of these drawings, the black resin that we're sitting next to, you know, none of the main elements break the outer edge of the plane at all.
Right.
And so I've been drawing like that, but it started, and I like that, and it's exactly what I wanted. It's like, I'm showing you what I want to show you. This isn't a piece of a larger world, but now I've become more comfortable with both the technique and the imagery that I'm using, and realizing that the depth and expansiveness that I'm going after is aided by just even the slightest suggestion that the imagery leaves the page.
Mm.
You know, most of what I do still isn't just sort of breaking the plane. It's not super asymmetrical, but I feel like I've earned the ability to use illusion
mm-hmm.
on individual layers rather than creating the illusion through multiple layers.
How do you think of the issues in your work of abstraction versus concretism? You know, of that you're building, you're not abstracting something else,
mm-hmm.
but once you start using the illusion of depth, you are sort of suggesting an abstraction from something else, as opposed to,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do you square that? Because that's a big shift, right, for a reality-based...
Yeah, I think in some weird way, I'm sort of... that sounds dumb, but I'm just trying to rebuild the world,
uh-huh.
but with me in control of the parts. You know,
uh-huh.
so obviously if this stuff's going to continue to grow and progress, it's going to have to expand. And as it expands, it's going to get more dimension. It's going to get more depth and detail and incorporate more things and maybe become slightly more representational. But I see that as a pretty slow process.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's growth, because what I do is angular and mathematical. looking and is in many ways based that way, but, you know, it's organic. You know, how I work is organic and fairly spontaneous. I developed a vocabulary, and then how do you apply that vocabulary? It's, you know, I'm horrible with words and I couldn't write a poem to save my life, but I feel like that must be the same way it works. You know, I understand individual words. I'm horrible with putting them together. When I listen to music, I don't hear the lyrics. I hear the lyrics as sounds, but I don't hear the narrative. But some people go, oh, this word can mean this, and then, well, if I put it right next to this other word that means this, then what happens when those are together? Mm-hmm. And that, but that's how I think of with lines, points, and planes. It's like, what happens? Mm-hmm. I think it can be sublime. I think there can be poetry in it. I think it can be expressive, though. I think people tend to see geometric work like mine and think it's not about expression. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, about hard edges. Mm-hmm. And I don't.
Do you surprise yourself with the work when you're making it? Do you see things put together and you think, oh my God, that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's...
That's an event that I didn't foresee on the
definitely.
Picture plate.
And that's why I work in... The things that are here are built how they go. They don't get laid down to be worked on. They aren't constructed in sections laying down. This piece that's, you know, 15 feet long and cantilevers over your head is built standing up. And I do things in my studio to allow me to keep it standing up until it can support itself. Because I don't feel like I can make good decisions unless I'm relating to it like I will relate to it as it's installed. So that thing stands up in my studio, supported by strings from the ceiling until it can support itself. And that's why I do tests this way, and that's why, you know, I don't plot the points ahead of time, because I want that little bit of wiggle room, because I think that's, you know, even in higher mathematics and physics, you know, there's a beauty in how you maneuver the numbers. And at base, or even computers, when people ask me about computers, computers are ones and zeros, or whatever my understanding of them is, and those came from a human brain. How do you arrange those to create, make this thing do its job, mm-hmm. whatever that is? So I think it's a very human act to want to work with ones and zeros and basic building blocks. I don't think it's overly logical. I just think it's going back maybe a few steps.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
You've been listening to Invisible, the Stranger's Weekly Conversation with People in Art.